Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Just north of the Herring River on the bayside of Eastham is First Encounter Beach. First Encounter refers to a skirmish in 1620 between the Nauset tribe and a group of Europeans who had recently arrived on the Mayflower. By no means was this the first time Native people encountered Europeans, nor was it a friendly interaction. Despite that, the story of the first encounter became part of our country's founding narrative and has been embraced locally to highlight the role of Cape Cod and Eastham. Today we discuss the story of the first encounter at Nauset, a new book about events before, during, and after colonists and Indigenous people met that day in 1620. In a few minutes, we're joined by historian and author of the book, Ian Saxine, along with Paula Peters, a member of the Wampanoag tribe, to discuss what shapes historical narratives and how historical myths are created and perpetuated. But first, we welcome Deborah DeJunker Berry, director of the Eastham Public Library, and Tom Ryan, vice chair of the town of Eastham's 400 Commemoration Committee. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So, Tom, as the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower approached, what kinds of discussions were going on in Eastham about how to acknowledge the milestone and the role of Eastham in that historical event?
About 3 years ago, some of us started meeting. We realized that this was our local piece of the origin story, and that we, if to be true to our history and true to ourselves, it would be good to examine this origin story of this little corner of Cape Cod Bay. And so we knew, first of all, that we wanted to retell the story, to relook at the story, because some of the elements were very mysterious. And also many people, even locals, didn't know much about it. So we knew we wanted, number one, to commission a historian and to cooperate with the Wampanoag Mashpee tribe on creating the narrative. And secondly, we knew we wanted programming this year to address the meanings of this story for us today.
Yeah. So, Tom, what role does the story of the first encounter play in the current identity of the town of Eastham? And were there concerns that presenting a more thorough accounting of the event would ruffle some feathers?
Certainly there was concern. Well, we saw some feathers ruffled. So we knew that feathers could be and would be and were being ruffled by any reexamination of the sort of canonical story that we inherited from the, 100 or 200 years ago. So we knew there would be some of that. But we also knew that, number one, without knowing about the pandemic we would have, we thought there'd be a lot more tourists. So we thought there would be an economic impact positively upon the town because of the 400 commemoration. But also in our education, we want the students to learn about their local history, not just universal.
Yeah. Deb, how did you find Ian Saxine and why did you choose him to write the book?
Well, as Tom said, we really wanted to tell our story, and we wanted to tell our story as best we could to have the Native American voice represented. And so we were looking for someone who could help us with that. And the journey was a little bit long. We decided, because we wanted to publish, we wanted to make the story available. And so we were working on a Mass Humanities grant. And Catherine Stevens from the Humanities was amazing. And she gave us so much advice and just walked us through every step. And part of that was finding our scholar. The grant required humanities scholars, and Tom was one. And then we needed our scholar to do the work. And then we also needed folks from the tribe to kind of guide us to make sure we were, going the right direction. So it was around the Christmas holidays, and it was not easy. I did the research online on the internet, and we're so gifted with all the academic institutions we have around here. But one of them, the websites I looked at in the different history departments, and also the English departments. I remember talking to Dr. Wayne Anderson at Bridgewater, but then I realized how lucky we were right in our backyard to have Bridgewater University. And so then I really seriously started to look at all the individuals in the history department. And then I read Ian's biography. And I called him. He called me right back, and we talked, and he was exactly what we were looking for. We were looking for a youthful voice. He had a work coming out right around the corner called Properties of Empire, Indians, Colonists, and Land Speculators on the New England Frontier. So he knew about New England and Maine, and a lot of his research had to do with Indian deeds. And one of our mysteries, as Tom said, was we have a deed hanging in our town administrator's office, and we wanted to understand that better as well.
Tom, there were a number of events about the book done virtually because of the pandemic, as you mentioned. So what was the reaction of the community to the version of this first encounter?
I think that the reaction was extremely positive. And even those whose feathers were somewhat ruffled enjoyed reading the entire narrative and taking part in our watching our virtual programming, our videos online. Because they wanted to see what we were saying. So whether they were ruffled or pleased, everybody was very interested in learning more.
Yeah. Deb, what do you hope readers take away from this account?
To keep an open mind, to understand that, you know, first, you know, we always hear that history is always written by the victors, but also that with science, we continue to learn more. You know, the planet tells us its story if we listen and watch. And so, but to me, that's the big message. The story will continue to evolve.
Deborah DeJonker-Berry, Director of Eastham Public Library, thanks so much for being with us this morning, Deb. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Mindy.
You bet. Joining us now is Ian Saxine. He's a visiting lecturer of history at Bridgewater State University with a research focus on colonial and Native American history. He's also host of the public history podcast, Mainly History. His most recent book is The Story of the First Encounter at Nauset, commissioned by the Eastham Public Library. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
Also with us, Paula Peters, member of the Wampanoag Tribe and co-founder of Smoke Signals. Paula, welcome back.
Hi.
Hi. So, Ian, what were your first thoughts when Deb contacted you about researching and writing this story at First Encounter?
So, to be honest, I was not, I initially tried to refer them to somebody else, and I'm glad that it didn't happen that way. I was afraid that this project was going to...
Ian, you know what? We've got a really bad phone line. I'm going to let Amy try to get you back on a better line, and we'll have a better signal, I hope. Paula, the Nauset people were one of many groups that make up the Wampanoag tribe today. Was this particular skirmish between the Nauset and the Europeans in December of 1620 mentioned in tribal history accounts that you know of?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that tribal history accounts don't exist in the same way that we have diaries, we have journals, we have maps and letters that are all written by the English. But it is not difficult at all to interpret through what has been documented by Europeans and colonists what the reaction of indigenous people would have been to the behaviors. We also know that we have traditional stories and cultural norms that are passed down through the centuries. And by the time our people began to document things, you know, we are able to know and have a much better sense of what was the reaction to having been colonized.
Yeah. So, Paula, what are some of the stories that you heard as a child about the arrival of white people, and how did they differ from what you may have learned in school?
Well, I grew up in a Wampanoag household, albeit back in the 1960s. And my father, in particular, Russell Peters, was always instilling in us that, you know, we are the Wampanoag. We are the people of the First Light, and making sure that we understood the significance of our heritage. And that was something that was not always backed up when I went to school. You know, the curriculum of the day and for many years to follow was, you know, that of courageous pilgrims and albeit savage Indians, and you know, it was not a true portrayal of who our ancestors truly were. And, you know, I learned that from a very young age.
Yeah. Must be so frustrating, you know, having to sit in this classroom and listen to those kinds of stories. But Ian, for those who aren't familiar with what happened on the beach that day in 1620, give us sort of the short version of what happened.
So the short version is this was the third shore party sent from the Mayflower. And after the Mayflower sent a ship ashore, they were running out of food. They were running out of supplies. They started digging around looking for Native American food supplies. They engaged in a bit of grave robbing, it turns out, in the process. And then the local Nauset finally attacked this shore party from the Mayflower at dawn in an effort to drive them off. And it worked. There was a firefight. We don't know if anybody was actually hurt. There's no record of anybody hurt on the English side, and no confirmed on the Nauset side either. And then the shore party from the Mayflower went back to the ship, and they sailed down the coast and ended up in what is today Plymouth, but was at the time the site of the Patuxet village, which had been devastated by plague.
So Ian, the story of the first encounter is not new. So what makes your account different?
My account takes a fresh scholarly look, and one of the things we try and do is take seriously the humanity of all of the participants equally centered. And so this is not a story of just the experience of the Mayflower passengers and what they went through, but we really try to center as much as possible the Wampanoag themselves, as well as the Plymouth colonists. And quite honestly, that's not something that has been done very frequently, unfortunately, until recently.
Yeah. Tom, history is not fact if we think of facts as unchanging truth. History is a story, and historians the storytellers. So what kinds of questions should we ask ourselves about historians and their accounts of what happened in the past?
I think we should ask who is writing the story, and we should ask what sources they are using in telling that story, and then also how we frame the story itself. For example, if we're just going to look at the first encounter at Nauset, we'll get one result. But if we see it in the context of decades of explorers, of kidnappings, of other encounters, we get a different result. So those are at least some of the initial questions I would look at in evaluating whether I want to read a history or commission a history.
Yeah. Paula, you mentioned the history of the Wampanoag people, a lot of that being passed down orally. So what role does myth and storytelling have in Native culture?
Well, of course, the myths and storytelling are part of our traditional life here in Mashpee. We have a Granny Squanet who visits the children each year around Halloween time. We have Puckawudgies who are mischievous and play a role in teaching our children how to behave. You know, there are a lot of those things, but I think that what we're missing here is something that Ian and other historians and scholars like himself are doing now, which is balancing the history. And I think of it more in the way of, you know, I have a journalistic background, so if I were a journalist, how would I look at history? And I would bring out all sides of it. And for so many years, and for so hundreds of years, the Wampanoag and indigenous stories across the country have been marginalized. And really, all you have to do is what Ian did and what I've done in some of my works is pull those stories out of the margins. We aren't reinventing history. We are taking those stories and illuminating the obvious, quite honestly. So when you think about what Ian just said about how graves were robbed and food was stolen, of course the Nauset fired a warning and said, get the hell out.
Yeah. And how often are historical writings a collaborative effort? And is this becoming more common as we start to address what's been left out of historical narratives?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. First of all good historical writings are going to be collaborative. There's no way you can write a book without assistance from archivists and members of communities and other sorts. And so my fortunate, I was lucky to work with the Peterses, of course, but that's sort of necessary for any project. I would say it's becoming more common, though, for especially non-Native scholars such as myself, who work on Indigenous issues, to realize that if you're not taking seriously what the Indigenous perspective is and what their sources of knowledge are, that you're missing out.
So how do historians try to keep their biases or perspectives out of the narrative?
To begin with, you have to be open about your own. Everybody has a bias, right? And so you want to make sure that you're open with yourself about what you expect the way the world works or who these people are, and make sure that that doesn't run away with you when you look at the actual sources. And so one of the things I was surprised by about the Plymouth colonists is that they didn't really have much of an agenda for sort of spreading. They were not sort of forerunners of manifest destiny in the sense that they wanted to form this little religious utopian community. And they viewed the original Plymouth town, viewed the founding of Eastham as a real disappointment because it meant their community of true believers was separating. And they did not view it as this sort of just unquestioned success where they were sort of spreading from sea to shining sea or any of that kind of thing.
We're discussing the story of the first encounter at Nauset, a new book about events before, during, and after colonists and Indigenous people meet in 1620. If you have a question or a comment, you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the story of the first encounter at Nauset, a new book about events before, during, and after colonists and Indigenous people meet in 1620. With us is the book's author, Ian Saxena. He's a visiting lecturer of history at Bridgewater State University with a research focus on colonial and Native American history. He's also the host of the public history podcast, Mainly History. Paula Peters, member of the Wampanoag Tribe and co-founder of Smoke Signals, and Tom Ryan, vice chair of the Town of Eastham's 400 Commemoration Committee and senior producer of the 106 videos on the first encounter on eastham400.org. So, Ian, what kind of source material were available to research this story? As we mentioned, we didn't have a lot of written accounts from the Indigenous people's side. So what was available that you could put this story together?
Right. So the short answer is not much. And so there's a handful of surviving texts from the 17th century that were very valuable. The most famous is William Bradford's own account of Plymouth Plantation, but that was written several decades after the so-called first encounter. There were several short publications in the 1620s describing the progress of the Plymouth colony. The most famous of which has become known as Mort's Relation, that was published in 1622. But then, this text, my account of the encounter on the beach and the surrounding areas, it was really drawn from just a handful of 17th century texts. And so I was very open in the book that we don't have any new sources from that era. Nobody's attic, we didn't find anything in the attic. This is just about bringing in the accumulated expertise and these different perspectives from the previous half century or so.
Yeah. Paula, what do you consider to be the biggest myth associated with the first encounter or the arrival of the Mayflower?
Well, hands down, it's that the Nauset and the Wampanoag were quote-unquote hostile. And that was a myth that was carried on for many, many years, centuries, really supporting the altruism of colonization, that the way in which to justify colonizing people, because you don't just have a colony without colonizing someone, But the way to support that is to portray those people as hostile and barbarian. And that is just simply not true.
Yeah. Ian, what about for you? What do you consider to be the biggest misconception?
I would say that the biggest misconception is that they were called pilgrims, and mm-hmm. that this was an honorific given to them 200 years after the fact. And it was mostly shaped by 19th century New Englanders who wanted to root American sort of democratic republican traditions in the days of early colonization. And so they came up with this entire honorific story, turning this band of religious utopians into forerunners of religious pluralism and representative democracy. And they were not. This doesn't mean they were, you know, bad people or anything like that. It's just that was very much not their agenda.
Yeah. Words matter. And the introduction of the book mentions familiar terms that won't be used, right? So and pilgrims was one of them. So tell us what the terms are and why you didn't use them.
Sure. And so the first was pilgrims, because that would be like writing a history of World War II, in which every time you refer to the 101st Airborne, you call them the greatest generation. They didn't use that themselves, right? The second, and I think this is most important, I don't think it's appropriate to call what the English people coming over were settlers, because that implies where they moved was wild and unsettled, and that was not the case. It was very it was populated, and it was full of, you know, communities, thriving human communities, and it also implies that what the English did was bringing order as opposed to oftentimes unsettling local communities. If I move to your town and I start burning down some of the buildings there and say, by the way, this is mine now, I don't think that your town is going to consider what I'm doing to be settling your community.
Right.
And then the other one was I didn't use Indians either, since we know what the locals called themselves. There's no need to construct language to flatter the sensibilities of one side or another.
Right. Tom, myths have long been a part of the human experience. What is the value of myth in human culture?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between the myths like, say, a creation story. And I know the Wampanoag have a creation story that sounds make-believe, but it brings meaning to their lives, I'm sure. Christians and Jews have a creation story in the book of Genesis, which sounds very strange, but brings meaning to people. So that's one kind of myth. We almost need a second word for what we're talking about in terms of the pilgrims and the Mayflower, where people in the 1800s mostly made up, basically, actually lied in certain cases or exaggerated, made up so-called facts to create sort of a white Protestant America. And it was anti-Catholic, it was anti-Native American. But I don't like to call that myth in the same way as creation stories, for example.
Yeah. Lee writes in, there's a great African saying, the story looks very different if written by the hunter or the lion. Good point, Lee. Thanks for sharing that. And then Helen writes, where can we find the book? Is it available on the CLAMS network with the library system, Tom?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so just Absolutely. Check with your local library, Helen. You should be able to get that.
And yeah, also at the Eastham Library website, the entire book is online.
Oh, great. Okay. Let's dig a little deeper into some of the myths, starting with religion, and you touched on this. You write in the book, the idea that they, the colonists, would be celebrated as essential trailblazers for a new nation based on the ideals of religious toleration and individual rights that, separated from the British Empire in a violent revolution, would have seemed ridiculous to the tiny band of religious utopians and fellow travelers who arrived on the Cape in 1620. Why would that be ridiculous to them?
So it's important to understand that from the perspective of most Christians, certainly at that time period, religious toleration was bad because it meant you lost. It meant that you were not able to create a godly community. And the passengers of the Mayflower, the so-called pilgrims, they were theologically pretty similar to the Puritans who arrived in Massachusetts about a decade later. And so these people very much believed that if you do not carry out God's will and form godly communities and respect his law, not only are you doomed to eternal damnation, but also you might be in for a good smiting right now. And so it was a matter of personal safety. The second reason is because the Mayflower passengers, those who were devout Calvinists, Reformed Protestants, they had already lived in the Netherlands for about 10 years and had enjoyed relative religious toleration. And so the Netherlands really were pluralistic, and they were also a republic. And so the reason why the Mayflower passengers left the Netherlands is because their kids were turning Dutch and were losing their religion. And they were proud English people who wanted to be both English and godly Protestants. And they couldn't do that in the Netherlands, they thought, and they couldn't safely do it in England either, where if you criticized and separated from the Church of England, headed by the monarch, that was a political act of disobedience as well, with the accompanying threats to your personal safety.
Many, as we were saying, many of the accounts of the arrival of the Mayflower talk about founding or discovering of this land. And we know the truth is that there were already well-established communities of people in place. Paula, how were the Nauset living on this land that we now call Cape Cod in the 1600s?
Well, the Nauset village is, it's presumed to have been a seasonal village, for one thing, because coastal living was something that the Wampanoag would take advantage of in much the same way that we do, coming to the coast, enjoying the shell fishing, the fishing, and also planting their gardens there, which is why all of that stores of corn was found at Nauset. And at the time of the pilgrims arrived, at the time that the colonists arrived on the Mayflower, the Naussets were among those who had been largely spared from the Great Dying, which was the plague that had infected so many tribes and villages from Maine to Cape Cod. So they still had some strength and might about them, and you know they were people that were obviously had a great deal at stake in defending their homeland.
And it was around 1616 Native people in New England area began dying of this mysterious sickness. What do we know of the origin of the illness, and how did it impact Native communities?
So we don't know for sure what the medical classification of this is. It's been called a plague. 17th century sources, when a lot of people got sick and died, that was their default term. But a descendant of what is popularly known as the Black Death really was endemic around parts of Europe and Asia at this time, and could have been carried over by European fishermen at this point. And so that is probably the best bet of what happened, and that it spread from somewhere on the east coast of New England, up and down, beginning in 1616 and running at least until 1619. And we know that in some parts of the coastline, including the town of Patuxent, which is now the site of Plymouth, sometimes up to 90% of residents of some communities died.
Go ahead,
if I could jump in, it's just really important to note, I mean, it's we know this to be true, that there were absolutely no immunities among the indigenous population. They had not experienced this before. So in many ways, it's much like the pandemic we're experiencing right now. There's no immunities. There's no vaccine. There's no treatment. And that's why people died so quickly.
Yeah. I think one of the things I didn't realize.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say it was the lack of because the Nauset and their neighbors did not keep livestock and live with them, livestock are the major vectors for many of these big diseases that have killed humans throughout history.
And that was the question I was just going to ask. I didn't realize that we had no livestock before the settlers came.
Yeah.
So that makes so much sense.
Just dogs.
Dogs.
We often
focus on the differences between the colonists and the native people. And Ian, you write in the book that the lifestyles of the Europeans and the native people were actually quite similar. So explain that.
Yeah. So I think that's important for us to recover that everybody living before the industrialized age, they lived materially quite similar lives, or much more simple lives. Their homes were smaller because they had to heat them. Most people ate food that was grown or caught very near where they lived. Food preservation was difficult. And making things like clothes or material possessions was difficult. And so most people didn't have a lot of stuff. Most people around the world were very in tune with the weather and the seasons, and they lived according to these seasonal rhythms of plenty and then lean times at certain parts of the year, depending on harvest and availability of fish and game. And remembering that also, I think, prevents us from seeing the English and the Wampanoag as these totally different people with nothing in common. When in fact, in many ways, in the big stuff, they actually were much more alike to each other than either of those people are to modern folks in certain ways.
Rick writes, what were historical responses from other tribes in North America to European contact, the French versus English versus Spanish landings?
I mean, the short answer is it really varied. And unfortunately, you know, that... That could be an entire episode or more unto itself, right? But it's, so it's very much, you know, when the newcomers behaved poorly, they got a reception like the Mayflower parties did when they robbed graves. And when the newcomers behaved themselves well, they were viewed as valuable trading partners and allies and sometimes spouses.
Bonnie writes, why did the settlers use the word plantation, which is now being replaced?
So this refers to quite literally just the English planting people, but also the idea of gardening. And the English were very, very big on the idea that farming in the English way improves the land and civilizes people. And so this was very much tied to their idea that they were going to plant themselves, but then also plants and improve the land. And this term, by now, of course, acquired the association with chattel slavery of African people. That was a frequently accompaniment to many of these plantations, especially in the Caribbean, right? But initially, it was a much more generic term that was tied to this agricultural idea.
We're discussing the story of the first encounter at Nauset, a new book about events before, during, and after colonists and indigenous people meet in 1620. If you have a question or a comment, send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the story of the first encounter at Nauset, a new book about events before, during, and after colonists and indigenous people meet in 1620. With us is the book's author, Ian Saxine, visiting lecturer of history at Bridgewater State University with a research focus on colonial and Native American history. He's also the host of the public history podcast, Mainly History. Paula Peters, member of the Wampanoag tribe and co-founder of Smoke Signals, and Tom Ryan, vice chair of the Town of Eastham's 400 Commemoration Committee and senior producer for the 106 videos on the first encounter on eastham400.org. Paula, another tragic interaction that predated the first encounter was the kidnapping and enslavement of Native people by Europeans. Do you remember when you first heard about this, and if so, how it was described within the Native community?
Well, I probably had heard about it even at a young age, but it became more clear to me the incredible impact, excuse me, as I began working in interpretive history at what is now known as Plymouth and Patuxent, and I was about 15 years old then. And it made me so angry because the story of Squanto is one that casual consumers of history just accept when they hear about this friendly Indian that came to the Englishmen and spoke to them in their own language. And we don't question, or it is the quintessential marginalized story. Because if we knew that he was kidnapped from Patuxent 6 years earlier, if we knew that they had tried to sell him into slavery in Spain, that he lived as a captive of curiosity in London for so many years, and then found his way home, only to discover that Patuxent, the place of his home, was completely wiped out by the plague. You know, he didn't have anyone. He came home and was literally a man without a country. That is so much of the story. And if you are Wampanoag, and even if not, it's a story that makes you very angry.
Yeah. Ian, do we know how other European colonists at that time responded to the capture and enslavement of Native people?
So, not all of them. So one thing we should say is that for English people in the 17th century, they knew about slavery. Slavery was a fact of life. By the early 1600s, Europeans had been trafficking in enslaved African people for almost 200 years. But then also English people were being captured and sold as slaves by raiders from North Africa at different times. And so there was not a lot, there was not an organized English sort of anti-slavery movement at this time. And so we do know that various English people believe that what the captain's name was Thomas Hunt when he kidnapped seven Nauset and 20 Patuxets in 1614. A number of English people criticized that, partly on moral grounds, but also on practical grounds of not irritating the locals and sort of ruining the area for future colonization.
Hmm. And then I'm trying to remember the year when they were looking for help for the boy, the settler boy that what year
oh,
was
I believe
the,
that when was 16, that 21 I think
yeah 16, so 21. And I mean when you think about how gracious they were to help the settlers, right?
Yes. Yes, and it was also I'll let Paula take this one. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. It was the Billington boy, young John Billington, and
right.
He was actually bounced from one village to the next. So it seems almost intentional that I believe he was in Ayano's village first, and they sent him to Nauset to be recovered there. And I think that was very intentional because the people of Nauset then they held the boy, but also they delighted in him and they gave him trinkets and fed him and took great care of him. And when they delivered him back, it was the English came and they were in the bay and they were really, I think, quite fearful of what was about to happen because the Nauset people had lined the shore with their warriors, but they handed the boy over very peaceably, but in a way that was clearly intended to be here. You know, we are not savages. We would never harm a boy, but also we are a strong people.
Yeah. So, Ian, you write in the book that both the colonists and the Nauset could view that day, that first skirmish, they could both see themselves as victorious. So explain. This is, I think, very interesting how they both could think that they were victorious in this skirmish. Explain that.
Sure. So the English framed it as they said, we defended ourselves and nobody in our party was hurt. And the Nauset withdrew from the battlefield. And so therefore, by the rules of engagement, we won. And that's how they framed this, with God's help. For the Nauset, the purpose of this attack was a show of force to make the intruders go away. And for war leaders throughout New England around this time, success was shown in achieving your objectives, but also by minimizing loss to your own side, minimizing damage and death in your own community. And so the point of this war party, of this assault, I should say, was not to just kill everybody in the party, but to make them go away to achieve that objective. And so since the shore party left and didn't come back, and since the Plymouth colonists ended up constructing their town on the site of Old Patuxent instead of among the Nauset, I would be very surprised if the Nauset didn't think of that as a really good thing at the time, and therefore as a success.
Yeah. And how did the Europeans' view of land use and ownership compare to that of native people, and how did that play out?
Sure. So we should add, in the anthropological sense, both cultures had property, in the sense that they believed that individuals or groups had limited access to resources and areas and could limit who got to use it, right? Among the Wampanoag, along with their neighbors, this land use, this property, was generally collective. And so to make a long story short, the Wampanoag and their neighbors would have viewed themselves as custodians of the land and waterways in cooperation with other human and spiritual entities. And the different communities would have limited resource use based on what they thought was best. For the English, they also justified their system of property with sort of spiritual language, in this case, from the Book of Genesis. And for the English, the mark of true civilization was private property and individual land holdings, by which usually male heads of household would, as the English would call it, improve the land. So plant crops, build fences, raise livestock. For the English, property was very much an aspect of an individual resource. And we should add, for the English, when they met other people, whether those people were Irish or Wampanoag, how those other cultures themselves thought about property was often the most important quality that the English examined when they were sort of measuring up other civilizations.
You write in the book that interactions between the Nauset people and the colonists on the Cape were relatively peaceful in comparison to interactions in other parts of the region. What are some of the reasons why?
So the most important region is geography. Because the Nauset and neighboring communities, they were the numerical majority of the Cape for much of the 17th century. And so the English, the relatively small number of English people who moved to the Cape after 1620, they knew that they were in the minority, and so that they should probably mind their manners. But by the 1660s and 1670s, the Nauset and their neighbors also knew that in the grand scheme of things, they were in the minority. And they were relatively isolated from other indigenous communities, and so it would not make sense for them to, when full-scale war broke out in New England in 1675, which is today known as King Philip's War, the indigenous communities on the Cape, by and large, decided that they were safer staying out of it than getting involved. And so both communities were aware that it was probably just not a very good idea for them to resort to physical violence to solve their problems.
So fast forward to today, what is the relevance of the story today? And Tom, let's start with you.
I think one of the relevances of environment, when we try to find where the first encounter happened, some of the historians say, well, it was about a mile out to sea because of all the erosion, or because we've deforested the Cape since the time of the first encounter. So I think there are environmental questions to ask about what has happened in the last 400 years. There are also questions of migration, who was migrating, how were they migrating, how do immigrants come here now, how do we receive them now, how do different cultures interact with each other. And most importantly, I think Native American rights and our relations on Cape Cod between the various communities of color, Native Americans, and all other people. So I think those are at least the top questions that we tried to address in about 100 videos that are on our website.
All right, Tom, Ian, same question for you. What is the relevance of the story today?
I think that for me, doing this project, which let me learn so much about it, is that really the often unappreciated connections and what I hope to be a better relationship between East Ham and Mashpee. Most of the Nauset and their neighbors, they didn't vanish. Most of them relocated down the road to the community of Mashpee after selling their lands under various degrees of kind of duress. But so to me, to tell the true story of East Ham, you have to look at its Nauset roots, but then also the fact that in many ways, a full story of the so-called first encounter for this community has to fully include the citizens of Mashpee as well as of the Cape, East Ham.
Paula?
Well, my answer is really very simple. It's that we are still here. And it is something that I've had an opportunity to reinforce thanks to Ian and to Tom and Deb. And, you know, we were really incredibly grateful for them to, in a very sincere and genuine way, want to tell our story and be inclusive of our voice.
Hmm. Paul, I'm just wondering your thoughts on how the rest of us can, you know, get the true history. I mean, this is one book, but just looking at, you know, Native American rights and the history we've been taught being, you know, much different than a lot left out, let's say. What are your thoughts on how we educate ourselves on all of the history, if you will?
Sure. I think that, you know, what I say to my kids and to people who are interested in history is, you know, to ask the obvious questions, like the obvious question about Squanto. How did he learn to speak English? And, you know, to question what you read and interpret it through, you know, try on a different hat now and then. And I think that that gives you a more balanced view of history.
And we will post links with more information about the story of the first encounter by Ian Saxing, along with the videos and presentations about the first encounter in Native history at our website, capeandislands.org. Ian Saxing, visiting lecturer of history at Bridgewater State University, and Paula Peters, member of the Wampanoag tribe and co-founder of Smoke Signals. Tom Ryan, vice chair of the Town of East Ham's 400 Commemoration Committee. Thank you all for taking the time to be with us and share your stories with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.